This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, a multi-award-winning, truly independent boutique wealth manager. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Lovely, Sean. Leon Kamfer, there's an interesting name. It's strange how these people affect us all in different ways. I remember him saying something that also stayed with me. He said the two things you need to guard against in a business, arrogance and complacency. And I've remained in that. I remind myself, not every day, but often, of that. So good for you, Leon. I mean, the impact that you've made. So what? If I understand correctly, you're saying it's like a Hemingway, sun also rises. How do you go bankrupt gradually, then suddenly? Is that where we are, as far as the US market's concerned?
I mean, it could go on for another year. We don't know. Okay. The point is, we're in injury time, because I mean, at the eventually, what happens is who's funding Anthropic and all these guys? Venture capital companies. Now, here's an interesting thing. One of the and private equity companies. One of the problems. It's an interesting conundrum, really, because normally when markets are at the highs, private equity companies are selling. They're exiting their businesses. They're selling to the market. And that's one of, historically, that's one of the signs of market tops. Oh, there's lots of listings. Okay. The problem is, with more than 50% of the money in passive funds, and passives only buy in indices, a new IPO is not an index. So private equity companies are struggling to exit for two reasons. One, you know, they only want to sell if they're going to get a higher price than what the portfolio is currently valued at. So either those portfolios are overvalued and they can't get those exit multiples. But two, there's just not the demand, because the passives, the active managers are busy swimming upstream, and the passive managers are not buying that stuff. So private equity companies, what they are now doing is they're trying to sell from, they launch new funds, and then they're trying to sell the assets from the one fund to the new fund. But you're getting to the point where investors want their money back. Okay. So when this money dries up, and all of a sudden, I mean, there was an article the other day, OpenAI are going to lose $119 billion in the next, before 2030. $119 billion. That's what their losses are going to be. And they're the big guys. How much are the little guys losing? So who's funding those losses? Well, it's investors. And so eventually those investors will say, you know what? We want our money back. We don't have any new money. That venture capital funds can't find new money. And that's when it all unravels. So we never know what causes the unraveling, but you just got to know that we are in injury time. And when we look at these large companies, you know, it wasn't long ago when, I think it was 2016, Apple had 25% of its market cap in cash. They've all been, you know, borrowing money to buy back stock. And now they're spending on this CapEx where they're not going to get a return, really. And so their balance sheets are not as good. And I mean, I think, was it Meta last quarter? You know, this is a $1.6 trillion company. Their free cash flow is $8 billion. Eight. So we're in injury time.
You mentioned Sir John Templeton. His CIO, Chief Investment Officer, for a long time was a guy called Nen, who wrote an absolutely magnificent book called Engines That Move Markets. And that was recommended to me by a guy from an asset management firm called Mundane. You think of a less marketing driven name of an asset management firm, but it's a wonderful, wonderful book, because if you read that book what he does is he takes all the great innovations. I don't know if you've read it.
I haven't actually read it. No.
He takes all the great innovations. It's a big fat book like this of the last 200 years, from telegraphs and railroads. And there is a very consistent theme that you have, like Darby was saying, overestimate to begin with, but underestimate in the long term. We certainly are overestimating. And his advice from all of this is, you can't pick the winners, but you can pick the losers. So we know AI is happening. We know there's going to be a lot of shakeouts. We know how good it is. But if you look at this world, who are the losers going to be? Who are the losers going to be by this AI revolution?
Well, I don't know if you, I mean, look, as I probably haven't read it because it's that thick. But Alec, you think back, let's just think back to this now. I mean, Nokia was It was a slam dunk. These guys, they developed the smartphone and da-da-da-da. They should have been the winner. They're a loser because Apple came and did something better than them afterwards, okay? You know, I mean, when we remember Alta Vista and remember Lotus.
They didn't develop the smartphone. They had the dumb phone. That was their problem. Apple brought the smartphone
well,
in.
The keyboard and the, you know. Mm-hmm. BlackBerry should have had the lead.
BlackBerry was,
you know, that should have. So, and I mean, the interesting thing is I keep hearing this, no, but AI is going to change the world. Yeah, well, of course it's going to change the world. It's changed the world. But air travel changed the world. Okay. Did you want to own Boeing and Airbus? It's a duopoly. Think about that. You know, telephony changed the world. Did you want to own AT&T and Verizon? Railroads changed the world. So throughout history, we've always had these things of changing the world. Let's not get too excited about it. You know, you've got, because there are going to be losers, and I worry that it's going to be the person in the street that's the loser.
Okay, now we have the perfect segue onto Bitcoin and crypto.
Yeah.
Is that going to change the world?
I mean, I'll tell you what I worry about there. There are now 140 Bitcoin treasury companies. Okay? If you're a successful business, are you launching a Bitcoin? They all fail. I mean, MicroStrategy was, business was going nowhere. Its revenue was falling. So now I was thinking about how is this going to unwind? So what happens, you get everybody out there becoming all the companies that are struggling becoming Bitcoin treasury companies. So that just saps the demand. Then they then issue debt to then use that debt to buy the Bitcoin. Okay, eventually that runs out of people going, well, hang on, why do I want a coupon of naught? Or there's a covenant breach or whatever. They turn from buyers to sellers. You've got a situation where the president of, I mean, there's another reason. You know, I mean, imagine if we had a situation where Cyril Ramaphosa was doing the kind of stuff that Donald Trump would be all over him. You know, you're getting gifts from this country and you know, your family members are benefiting from your regulation that you're imposing, we would be horrified. And yet we somehow just accept it because it's from the United States. So
benefiting. The numbers are eye-watering. $5 billion that the Trump family's made out of crypto?
Correct. It's eye-watering. So I like to think of things and go, okay, how much better could this get? Right. So we've got the president behind there. We've got all the treasury companies. And is Bitcoin hitting new highs? No. It's as good as it can get, and it's not hitting new highs. Okay? And I agree with Darby. Prices are interesting. And so I like to watch prices and get behind the psychology of the prices and go, that's very interesting. Good as it can get, not hitting new highs.
Tell us about your close colleague, Andrew Lapping. There are a lot of people here who would have invested in Alan Gray, and they don't know the connection.
So I met Andrew when I was at Orbis, and he was an analyst at Alan Gray, and he subsequently was appointed chief investment officer at Alan Gray Limited, which doesn't surprise me. I mean, he's absolutely brilliant. He's the best investor I've ever worked with, and I actually feel guilty that I'm out here, you know, the front face of it, because he is a huge part of our success, and he knows that I know that and think that. So he's a really he's a superb guy, and I'm extremely lucky to have him as a business partner. And I think we work really well together as a team, and we've both got quite a lot of experience. And so you know, I think we make fewer mistakes having a second pair of eyes of his quality in terms of our process. So he's a fantastic guy. I'm extremely lucky. So he's the second largest shareholder in the business. Okay. And together we have just under 80%.
I'm asking that because if you have a look at these two guys, yourself with your background and track record, and of course your performance, Andrew Lapping is probably better known to the people in this auditorium. And you stood up a couple of years ago and you said, hey, performance fees are wrong. And the industry's reaction to that was, oh, who's Sean Pesh? You know, why should we worry about him? First of all, why did you do that? Why did you stand up and say that performance fees are wrong, given that that's an additional tax for investors? And secondly, what's the reaction been now after the initial, hey, who's this guy?
Well, so it came about because I had a friend of mine who was an entrepreneur, and he wanted to put money in our fund. And he said, look, can you compare this fund to the one I'm currently in, which was a fund of funds from one of the brokers? And And so I did, and I couldn't understand. I thought when I did the chart, I thought, gee, have I got the currency wrong? Is it like ours and what, you know, what's, have we got the same currency? Why is ours so much better? And it was because of all the balanced funds. And then when you dig a bit deeper, all the balanced funds had performance fees. And what I was surprised, I mean, I've been out of the industry in South Africa. I mean, I've been in the UK for 24 years now. And many of them had performance fees that were based not against an index, but against, they created the index. It wasn't a uniform index. Okay. So they would say it's the average of our competitors, excluding us, or the median of our competitors, or whatever, in terms of the CISA categories. And so, you know, and I saw some of the mechanisms. And of course, years ago, I ran a hedge fund at Decillion. And so I know about performance fees, and I know about high watermarks and all the rest. And some of these things had rolling high watermarks. In other words, you can, you know, if you outperform, you charge a performance fee. If you subsequently underperform, you don't give it back in many of the mechanisms. You just don't charge it until you go back to that point. Okay. But if that point is more than 3 years, well, then you charge it again because it's a rolling 3 years or rolling 1 year. And so I just wanted to, and I actually, you know, run a Irish UCITS, and you can't charge performance fees to retail investors in Ireland. And so I just thought, okay, well, let's, you know, our performance was okay at the time. It wasn't, you know, where it is now. And our fact sheet wasn't great. And so when I went through this exercise, I thought, well, actually, I like that about that fact sheet. And I like this about that fact sheet. And we actually changed our fact sheet. So people's, the one criticism they threw at us was like, oh, you're doing this as a marketing exercise. Well, it wasn't really, because then I would have waited until our performance was really good and got our fact sheet great and then done it. But it didn't. So anyway, so I took a little bit of, I took a bit of heat. But, you know, I think you say what you believe, and that's what you do. So that's what I did. So anyway, yeah.
And you got Magnus, who's supporting you, and his clients are delighted as a result of it. Have you had any other big names coming?
So I mean, well, one of the other things we actually did at the time as well is we said, you know what, these are highly scalable businesses. I mean, when we first, when we first spoke, Alec, at that first conference, you know, we were, I don't know, $60 million or so, and I said that when we get to $200 million, we're going to set up a charity, which we've now done, but we $1.4 billion now, dollars. Sure. So, you know, and we've gone from 60 million to 1.4 billion. We haven't, so what's that, 20 times or whatever the number is, more than 20 times. We haven't taken 20 times more staff. So these are very profitable businesses. And so what we said is, well, look, we need to keep the lights on, but let's pass on some of those benefits to clients. So as we grow, we're going to reduce our fees. So he's charged 0.9% management fee on the first 500 million. The next 500 million, we charged 0.75, and everything over a billion, we charged 0.6. So it's a blended fee. So actually where we are at the moment is, I don't know, around just under 0.8, somewhere around there. That's the management fee. So as we grow, we're going to pass on the benefits to clients so that they get a lower fee and there's no performance fee. And we think we're earning a fair fee and we still got money to give away to charity. So,
and that's in pounds.
What?
$1.4
billion.
Dollars. Yeah. That's not why people start businesses, Sean. They actually want to increase the take as they get bigger. So, but I think the tribe know all about you and they understand your philosophy. And that's why you get so much support from the
tribe. Well, there's two things. The one is a great quote that a friend of mine said, you know, he said, you can only eat so much sushi. And so I like that. And the second thing is, you know, when I do subscribe to this, I think it was Maya Angelou who said, you know, when you know, teach, when you have, give. And so I'm not going to be one of those people who amass the wealth and give it away in my deathbed. I'm giving it away as we go, because I can compound wealth, but I can't compound wealth faster than people suffering. So it's just a different approach, I guess.
And you weren't lying. You weren't lying to me last night from Heathrow.
No. What are you about?
About sitting in the back of the bus.
Listen, at one point I thought I was sitting next to Travis Kelce, because he was an enormous American guy. I thought, where's Taylor Swift? I was sort of sleeping like this all night. Anyway, no.
All right, if the MSCI is now 73% of the invested in America, and you're worried about America, as you've articulated very well, what percentage should we have in America then? Or do you have in America?
Well, what we've got in America is just over 20%. And there are pockets of value. I mean, I wrote about in our latest fact sheet, and anybody who doesn't subscribe, you're welcome to go onto the website and just add your name, about a company called Sally Beauty Holdings. And Sally Beauty, which is a $1 billion company, and it's a small cap, okay? And they have 3,000 stores, and they sell most of their business is hair care. So it's color and extensions, things like that. Now, that's annuity income because those gray roots grow every month, okay? So you need to go and paint them off. And they've got a lot of private label, but then they also distribute. And what was interesting about this business is even during COVID, they made money because although the hairstylists closed, if you're a hairstylist and your salon you're working at closed, what did you do? You went and started your own thing. And so now they had more customers. And they've got a very good CEO, and they generate cash. And this thing was 5-6 times earnings because it's $1 billion. And that's well below all the passives, and it's just being ignored. And so we were picking this thing up, and it went up, and they released results earlier this month. And, you know, earnings have been growing for the last 3 quarters year over year. And now it was a double digit. I mean, buying back stock and sensible, and they don't pay themselves crazy numbers. And the stock's up 39% and still on 7.5 times earnings. And so you can find these little pockets, but they're not in the big passives. You know, they're not in the S&P 500 index where you've got massive exposure to those tech companies. And so, you know, we've got companies like Expedia. I mean, Expedia is a big brand name, but its market cap's 24 billion. You know, booking.com, we all know its market cap's 180 billion. You know, so Alec, there are these opportunities in Asia, but you know, what I wrote about in the fact sheet was that smaller companies have been ignored as this huge amount of money has been pouring in to the large passives. What I think's interesting is if you look at the price relative, okay, small caps over the last 6 months have outperformed large caps. And that's with Microsoft coming out with great numbers and Nvidia coming out with great numbers and all this. So that's what you got to look at. You know, it's no good finding out 3 years later, oh, well, you know, look at that over the 3 year numbers, the small caps are great. Let's go and buy the small caps. Okay. It's happening now. And I think it's, okay, I said what I said. I'm not sitting in cash. I mean, we've got a little bit of cash in the fund because we take profits. And if we haven't got something to buy there, then we're happy to sit with cash. But it's not like I'm so worried that I'm selling everything and putting it all in cash, because what happened in April was interesting. We actually went up over that period because people were selling the stuff everybody else had and buying the stuff that we had. So, you know, you think, oh, well, but if America catches a sneeze, we're going to catch a cold. Well, it doesn't always happen is like that. If people are now saying, let's get out of the States and go and find some other regions, and you're in those other regions, those stocks could actually go up. So you want to stay invested, but you want to stay invested. You don't have to stay invested in the same stuff that you're currently in, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, we got lots of questions for you, Sean. Let's start off from Mike Potts. At BNC One last year, investment into India was discussed as a good diversification option. What's your current thinking, particularly looking at investments into India versus Japan?
Yeah, we don't currently have any Indian stocks. And, you know, you got to think about the stories. I mean, a great case in point, we were buying Korea after there was martial law imposed, because that was a reason people weren't going there. Yet we've had troops in the street in Chicago and all the rest. And they're still there. So we don't have India exposure. It's a trickier market to invest in. You know, in terms of actually interestingly as well, I think I'm right in saying that it's one of the markets where if I buy an Indian stock and I sell that Indian stock and I make a capital gain, it gets clipped. But like Brazil. And there was talk that they were going to have that in the big, beautiful bill.
Just explain that.
You buy a stock at 100 and you sell it for 200 in Brazil. So you make 100 gain, capital gain. Okay, what'll happen is you don't get that 100 because they take, it's like withholdings tax on capital, on the capital gain. Yeah. No, they were talking about that section 899 in the big, beautiful bill. The America came this close to putting that in, which comes back to property rights that Darby was talking about. So I think I'm right in saying that they have something similar in India. So, you know, to us, we missed that story.
Trump is loved because he's a big disruptor, but wow. It comes with a cost. Sean, here's Henry Bierkus wants to know, Should I be worried about the US prices if my investment horizon is 30 plus years?
I mean, who knows what's going to happen in 30 years? Warren Buffett says, don't bet, betting against America has been a terrible thing to do. He's sitting in cash. So, you know, 30 years. Listen, I mean, we need to go back to history. At one point, Baghdad property was the most expensive property in the world. Okay? So things change. I mean, think about the, you know, okay, we're talking more than 30 years. But if you think of the UK, look how insignificant the UK is in the world's, you know, markets now. And that 30 years ago was a different story. So who knows what's going to happen in 30 years? And I think there's going to be, I think you don't have to wait 30 years for there. You don't need to. I mean, let's just talk about DeepSeek. Okay. I was rather hopeful. We had a small position in Alphabet. We've now sold that. Okay. It's moved a lot. But I was rather hopeful that all these technology companies announced, you had DeepSeek in January. And all the companies had announced their CapEx, but they all released results a few days afterwards. And I thought, I was rather hopeful that they're all going to look at DeepSeek and go, whew, what are those guys doing? Maybe we can cut our CapEx. Okay, so I thought there'd be a nice catalyst. These technology companies are going to be, that was one of the angles with Alphabet. They haven't, they've increased the thing. So, but I think if you look at the pace of advancement in China, I mean, NVIDIA didn't sell those H20 chips to China last quarter. They're doing their own stuff. And so the world is changing. 30 years is a big time, a long time.
They haven't got a Blackwell in China. And also as far as DeepMind is concerned, they've been at it since 2007. DeepSeek started just kind of the other day. So don't underestimate. Anyway, we'll disagree on Alphabet.
Okay.
What percentage of Randmore Global Equity in the U.S. from Gert Koos?
Sorry, what percentage?
Gert wants to know what percentage of Randmore's global equity is invested in the U.S.
Oh, just over 20%.
That was the point you made a moment ago. And then Graham from Mark wants to know, how do you hedge USA risk and what opportunity does an AI bubble represent?
We don't hedge currencies. We're a global fund and hedging currencies can be quite tricky because you could get a Korean company that sells in U.S. You know, you're hedging revenue. Are you hedging profits? Are you hedging listed exposure? What are you hedging? Can get, and I think it doesn't make sense, to be honest. So we global fund, we invest globally, you are nicely diversified, and you've got a diversified basket of exposure. So what does an AI bubble burst? We'll have to wait and see. I think it could be a rush to other assets.
Are you seeing it as what happened with the internet bubble burst, which lasted about, I don't know how many months, but it certainly wasn't a heck of a long time. What? Whereas compared with, or you're seeing it as something that'll be a complete flat tire?
It'll be, you know, Alec, we never know what's wrong. It could be a failed auction, which could just set it off. It could be a private equity round. These guys just don't get it away. We'll have to see what happens.
But the consequence.
What happened after the tech bubble burst is nobody wanted consumer staples. Okay. They all wanted the technology stocks. You wanted boring old Coca-Cola and those things. You can now buy brewers like Carlsberg on an 8% free cash flow yield. So maybe all of a sudden they go, well, actually, you know what? A decent 30 years' time, we know that people will be drinking beer. You know, we don't know whether they'll be using OpenAI. So you could get a similar to the last one correcting, you could get a rush to those kinds of companies, I would hope.
Okay. Remember that Amazon went up by quite a lot, but there were a lot of Amazon lookalikes that never came back. So I guess that gets back to Alistair Nairn's view. Be careful because you don't know how to pick the winners. Who knows?
But Amazon did go down 92% or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Had you bought it then, you would have changed your address many times.
That's right. But you wouldn't have felt good about it. You know, the problem was when Microsoft went down a lot and then the whole thing was, you know, it's what you rash. The story you tell yourself once it's gone down, it's like, maybe these guys are right. You know, it's fallen so far. Maybe they are running out of money. Maybe they are going to get, maybe, you know. So one's got to be careful because if you weren't holding Amazon, if you held Amazon and it fell 92% and went back, great. If you weren't holding Amazon and you're holding Nortel Networks, well, not so great.
And that's the point, again, that Nen was saying. In all of these huge booms, it's been almost impossible to pick the Amazons. And I understand where you're cautioning us there. Stuart Wilmington wants to know, I agree on your US thoughts. Are you still as positive on China as you were in March? Is the current crisis in China and the East delivering good diamonds?
Well, we've got around 40% exposure to Asia. And so that is mostly in Japan, Hong Kong, and South Korea. And the companies we've got, yeah, we like. So
Taiwan?
We've been looking at Taiwan. We've got one opportunity there that we're busy investigating in detail. We're less worried. It's interesting. I mean, are we less worried about this? I mean, is there going to be invasion? Isn't there? Who knows? I think that's, you're not going to be immune if you don't own Hong Kong. You're going to be, if China takes over Taiwan semiconductor, America's got a problem.
The world's got a problem.
The world's got a problem.
40% of microchips of the top quality. I know I'm reading a book called The Chip War now, should be required reading for everyone to understand. 40% of the semiconductors are made at TSMC and most of the high grade stuff. So if that happens, wow. Okay. The returns of your, from Peter Jenkins, the returns of your fund have been exceptional for many years now. How will you support this growth in the future? Wait for more black swan events? Nice question.
It is a nice question. I think this is quite an interesting point because we do get asked, well, your fund is at a high price now, I missed it. Okay. If you buy a buy and hold fund and the fund is at a high price, effectively all the underlying holdings are also at a high price. Okay. But because, what caused our fund to go up and in recent years would be things like European banks, we sold those. We've been buying some of these US medical insurers. Okay. Those things are nowhere near their high price. So in other words, the point being that we can rotate. We can sell, we sell the winners and buy other people's losers, etc. So we can rotate within our fund, which is, if you'd asked me at the beginning of the year, would we be up 36% on the 9th of September? I would never have thought so. But what is amazing is we don't think we're doing anything really special. We're just buying companies we think are undervalued. What we're not doing is worrying about the benchmark every day, waking moment. And we also very careful about stories. I mean, this morning I wake up on the plane or get off and I see Novo Nordisk is warned. And I go, well, hang on, that was such a great story 2 years ago. World's obese, two companies selling these obesity drugs. They're going to make $100 billion in the next couple of years. Boom, stock's down 70%. So one's got to be careful about stories because by the time the story is long in the tooth, it's in the price.
That's also an interesting parallel to what you've been saying about AI, because Novo Nordisk was going to have the world at its feet with this, which is Ozempic, is that their drug? And it was building all these new plants, like the AI companies are. Interesting.
Well, they used to call they called Novo Nordisk Europe's AI, Europe's Nvidia. Sorry, Europe's Nvidia. Yeah.
If from Talal Salim, if one sells overinflated stocks like technology, what would you put your money into? And what are good defensive stocks or investments?
Well, I mean, as I was saying, if you look at not just what I'm saying as well, but the likes of Jeremy Grantham, what do they say? Smaller companies, ex-US value, we're not paying for growth. That's what you want to do, I think. Might be early, might leave some chips on the table, but I think if the pawpaw hits the fan, you'll be happy.
Isn't that the whole thing about investing? You've got to be able to sleep at night.
Definitely.
And can you sleep at night with a big US exposure right now?
Well, that's right. Well, we don't have a big US exposure, so I sleep at night. And I mean, it's that story of the Jesse Livermore. I probably told you the story before, Alec, where this guy, Jesse Livermore was a famous trader in the US. And a person came up to him, and there was a futures, okay? So they would do futures, and they'd be doing, pork belly and cotton and wheat and all that sort of stuff. And this chap came up to him and said, Mr. Livermore, what do I do? I've got this huge cotton position. What do you think I should do about it? And he said, sell down to the sleeping position. Okay. Like, yeah, I missed the thing. I've got such, I can't sleep at night. I've got this huge position. What should I do? Sell down to the sleeping position. And so we don't have, you know, we don't use that word, that phrase, high conviction, because who knows what's going to happen? Is China going to invade? What's Trump going to do? All the rest. Oh, is there going to be a treasury strike, bond vigilantes? So we have smaller positions so that we're not betting the ranch. And smaller positions, well, they require a bit of work. You know, Warren Buffett says, well, you want diversification. Yes, but that's if you're Warren Buffett. If you're as good as Warren Buffett, yeah, then you can have a concentrated portfolio. But don't think if you've got no skills anywhere close to Warren Buffett, having a concentrated position is a good idea. It can be. But when it goes wrong, you've got to have the emotional fortitude of knowing what to do.
Reminiscences of a stock operator. Yep. And Jesse Livermore blew his own brains out.
Yeah.
So, didn't take his own advice. Gerrit asks, how do you distinguish between a business that's merely out of favor versus one in permanent decline?
Ah, so we for 90% of our stocks, what we like to do is we like to say, are conditions stable or getting better? Okay. And then is it cheap? If things are getting worse, like badly worse, and they've got lots of debt and they got, you know, we don't buy businesses that are losing money. Okay. Then because, yeah, so we'll stay away from those. We prefer companies where that are stable or getting better, where you can look a couple of years out and say, okay. So for example, you look at the medical insurers. You might say, well, hang on, shouldn't you just tell me about medical insurers? Now you tell me things are getting better. Well, think about a couple of years out. What happens with insurance companies when inflation, you know, you have hurricanes and all the rest? What do? They put up prices. Okay, so a couple of years. So now what are they doing? Well, they're going to push through higher prices, premiums, higher premiums. At the same time as $200 billion of drugs are coming off patent in the next couple of years. Well, that's good. These guys are not going to have to pay $200 billion. They pay a lot less. So actually, you could get a situation where things are getting better in 2 years, and that they massively out of favor. And, you know, surprise, surprise, Warren Buffett bought some United Health last quarter. So so that's what you want to be careful of. And you've got to look at the balance sheet. And that's why we look at balance sheets a lot, because they're very important. And so, you know, but if you asked me, are we, trying to think of a really good example, but are we buying US department stores? No. Okay. Yeah. So you want to be careful about businesses that are deteriorating and falling in a heap and revenue is declining. Because that's the other thing. If revenue is falling and costs are going up with inflation and you've got low margins, you go from a profit to a loss in 5 seconds. And if you've got a bad balance sheet, then that's a problem and things can spiral out of control quickly. So,
And Buffett's underlying recommendation is that when you become a shareholder in a company, you're a co-owner of it. And so many people look at names and they play with names and numbers and everything else, but you co-own that company. And if you wanted, or if you could buy the whole damn thing, would you pay the price that you're being asked? And sometimes just a basic thing like that misses us.
Oh, no, I think it's very important. I mean, let's come back to the Warner Brothers. I mentioned Warner Brothers earlier, Warner Brothers Discovery, okay? Masses of debt, greedy CEO, declining business. Because, you know, you're out there competing against Netflix and those kind of guys. Not going anywhere near it. It's not tricky.
Victor Hugo, my neighbor, he says, we have heard some of your comments on active and passive strategies on a one-year view in current global bonds and stocks. I think the best way of handling injury time in global or US markets is by combining active with quant triggers on risk triggers. Hello. Emphasize price to measure risk and return potential rather than value in inverted commas. What do you think of focusing on instrument price versus value in this environment?
I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, sometimes what happens, I think price tells you supply and demand. So, you know, if the price is going down, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that there's more supply than demand. Okay. And what I think you want to look at is, or one thing which is quite interesting is, I mean, I use the Bitcoin example. You've got a story, but actually it seems that it's topped out. Microsoft, go and have a look at Microsoft, compare the price that it opened at after they released their results to where it is now. It's down. Okay. A lot of the, I mean, Google's an exception, but a lot of the other examples, I don't know. So, I mean, we value investors, and sometimes price is the, or value is the catalyst. You know, we had Skechers getting bid for, we had Foot Locker getting bid for, and you can't buy that after the bid's been announced because the price has responded. You want to, you see, sometimes you got to buy the lottery ticket before they announce the winning numbers. So that's what I would say. But you know, prices can correct quickly. I mean, you know, think of a, you wake up, let's just say this weekend, China invades Taiwan. Well, you're going to, the price on Monday is going to be a very different picture. Okay. And then what are you going to do? Then you're going to go, oh, I should have sold yesterday. So now you get in the psychological loop. I didn't sell yesterday, but now I tell you what I'll do. Maybe it'll bounce a bit tomorrow. I'll sell tomorrow. Tomorrow it's down more. I really should have sold yesterday. And before you know it, it's like, don't worry. I mean, this is a 30-year investment. Okay. I mean, we've all been there. You can imagine that. So I think psychology is really, is an important part. And that's why doing this part-times, you know, I mean, why does Roger Federer and all these superstars, because they know we can all hit forehands and backhands, but they've got the psychology to win the match.
Well, active managers like yourself, you are focused on it, and that's what you do for a living, and you do it very, very well. And that's why we ask you all these difficult questions, like another one from Gert. He says, do you expect value of US dollar to decline materially?
I mean, we're seeing it this year. The euro is stronger. And
hey, the rand is stronger.
Exactly. So, you know, what is that telling you? And I think that's the other thing. And what's really interesting, you think about, go and have a look, you know, when Trump got elected and there were people who said, I mean, I know, I've got a friend of mine who runs a small and mid-cap manager, and their clients were going, that's it, we're done. It's Mag 7 all the way, et cetera, US all the way. Who thought in November last year that Europe would have outperformed the US to the extent that they have this year? Not many people, I don't think. So, and that's, you know, that's, so I think these currencies, it's already underway. And also remember the 30-year JGB, well, the Japanese government bond, okay, is now yielding 3.5%. I mean, it was yielding nothing 2 years ago. So if you can get a 3.5% in Japan, well, why do you need to take your money all the way to the States if the dollar is weakening to get 4%?
No private investor wants 3.5%. Come on.
No,
I'm not getting out of bed for 3.5% a year.
What do you,
give
you
me NVIDIA.
Alec, absolutely. It's that story where Warren Buffett, when Jeff Bezos asked Warren Buffett, well, this makes so much sense. Why doesn't everybody just invest the way you do? And what was Warren Buffett's answer? No one wants to get rich slowly.
No, but you don't get rich on 3.5%.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about, yeah, but you've got pension funds in Japan and all that sort of stuff. The point is they took their money. They're the largest investor in US government debt, Japan. Okay. And they did that because they're getting nothing at home. Now they're getting 3.5% at home. So the differential is not a, so the risk is that then I'll start move the money back and go, you know what, why don't we just do that? Okay. What does that do to the dollar? So.
Yeah. And the Chinese, maybe they want to do the same thing. And ish, did Donald Trump think that one through? Wow.
No.
Bitcoin is the best performing from Warren Wheatley. You had to know this. And you know, Warren's going to tackle you afterwards. So watch out. Bitcoin is the best performing asset for the last 10 years. What would need to happen for you to change your mind on it?
I mean, that's, look, I don't reinvest by looking in the rearview mirror. You know, you look in the rearview mirror, you're going to drive off the road. So what the best performing thing in the last 10 years was, you know, US technology stocks. The next 10 years are going to be very different.
So that's your view on Bitcoin?
Yeah, I'm not interested in Bitcoin. I don't get it doesn't give me anything. I'm totally reliant on somebody else coming over the hill and paying a higher price. That's the rationale.
Like gold.
Like gold.
You don't invest in gold either.
We don't have gold. We missed that one.
So you missed Bitcoin and gold.
That's right. But we still have, we managed to find a few other winners, so we're okay. We're not going to get them all, Alec.
Yeah, we mustn't be greedy on that one. There, last question from Raul Miller. There has been a growing value bias towards U.S. markets. How do you think about hedging against the risk in high valuations in the U.S.?
Well, it was you'll like this. It was Michael O'Leary from Ryanair, and they used to hedge their oil price or whatever, and one time they made a big loss on their hedge. And he said, I should have known from my horse racing days, behind, you know, Cheltenham, he says, behind every hedge is a ditch. So, you know, hedge, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, but, you know, just, I always just think it's I like a clean sheet approach. I used to think that, well, if my cat walked across the keyboard and sold the portfolio, which ones would I buy back today? Okay. And I like to do that quite a lot. You know, we had 3.5% in ABN AMRO, done really well. It's like, well, hang on a second. If we didn't own ABN AMRO, would we buy 3.5% today? No, we wouldn't. Okay, well, what would we buy? 1.5, right. Sell down to 1.5. So, you know, that's what, you know, versus hedging what you, I mean, if you, less tax is a real issue, and then you got to worry about the tax, but we don't have to worry about that. So if we think a stock is fully priced, we sell it. We don't sell covered calls and all of that. We don't hedge. We just sell.
Sean Pesh, thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, a multi-award-winning, truly independent boutique wealth manager. Invest better with Brenthurst.